at his body, to make it real to myself. His words ran down. You can't. Spark spoke the words sharply. We are too few to devoid ourselves, too poorly armed, and it serves no purpose other than to prolong your pain. She looked away from him. He's dead, I said softly. I looked up at both of them. For a short time I could feel him, connected to me. I felt him, and I felt Wolffather. They are gone now. He glanced at his gloved fingers, and then cradled that hand to his chest. I know, he admitted. But it was a terrible place to leave him, alone, with the water rising. Do we have a plan? Spark cut in sharply. Or do we just sit on this dock until they come to kill us all? Her voice was hoarse but level. Her throat was probably as dry as mine, and her stomach as empty. I was coming to like her. She had the same steadiness that Purr did, that same in-this-moment practicality. Her words snapped Beloved into a straighter posture. He looked over the huddled survivors and our thin line of protectors. Yes, one that is subject to much change, I fear. He pushed his damp hair back from his face. For now, yes, we remain on this dock. We are not a large enough force to protect ourselves if we venture into the town. Here and now, we have a somewhat defensible position. But no food, no water, no shelter from the sun. Injured folk. I did not think much of the plan of the man who had replaced my father. He folded his legs and sat down beside me. Spark copied him, and Purr came to join us. Boyo remained by the body. A muscled, scarred man was looking at Boyo's arm and the blistered burns on his face and elsewhere. Suddenly, Boyo sagged to one side. The man caught him and eased him down. He had fainted. Ant had a knife and was staring off toward the town. I did not know the names of the others. There were 11 of them. One kept watch out over the harbor. The afternoon sun beat down on all of us. The tide had turned and the waves were retreating, carrying the debris of our ship with them. The other large vessels that had been in the harbor were gone, save for one that was aground and listing. Purr spoke. If they come with archers as they did before, we have no cover. If they muster their courage and come by boat as well as on the shore, we will be quickly surrounded. If all they do is keep us here, we have no food, no water, no shelter from the sun. We will end here, I fear. Those things are true, but for now, they are far too busy dealing with dragons to bother with us, and it's only to get worse for the castle, and then the town. Beloved turned his oddly pale eyes towards Clary's castle. The blue and green dragons had finished with the small boats, leaving only floating wreckage on the water. The green one was now high above Clary's castle, wings spread, rocking in the air as an eagle does when it catches the wind and effortlessly rides it. The blue was actively harrying the castle, swooping and darting in a display of flight that mocked the archer's efforts to hurt him. Arrows still flew, but there were fewer in each volley. As I watched, the blue suddenly changed tactics. Graceful as an alighting swallow, the dragon swept in and up to perch atop one of the four's towers. It was not one of the outer watchtowers that he chose, but one of the taller structures within the stronghold. The blue trumpeted loudly as if calling to someone. Then he flung his head back and snapped it forward on his sinuous neck, mouth wide. Something sparkling flew from his open mouth. I heard distant cries.
He spits acid in a fine spray. Nothing stands before it. Not flesh or armor or bone or stone, Beloved told me.
I looked over at him. Hap sang to me of dragons. I know what they do. I thought of the placid, cheerful whites in their little cottages, their spotless flowing garments and picnic meals under the blossoming trees. They would be punished alongside Capra and the servants and their warrior guards. Did they deserve it? Did they know the harm their cached dreams had done to the rest of the world? I felt a twinge of pity for them, but no guilt. What was happening to them was as far beyond my control as a thunderstorm or an earthquake, or my own kidnapping and the sacking of Withywoods. The high-flying green gave a long, shrill cry.
Vengeance!
That was the word that rode on that sound. It echoed.
Vengeance! Vengeance! Vengeance!
Not an echo.
Oh, my,
Beloved said softly. The vision my father had given him was becoming keener. He had seen them before anyone else. Two little jewels, sparkling and twinkling in the distance. One glinted scarlet, and the other flashed bluer than the sky. Beloved lifted an arm and pointed.
Dragons,
he called to our companions.
Hebe and Tintaglia, unless I am mistaken. Rapskull said they would come.
With a rattle of plumes, a crow suddenly settled on Per's shoulder. I jumped back in alarm, but he laughed joyously. She was a strange crow with a silver beak, and instead of being black, she had a glittering blue to her feathers and several scarlet plumes in each wing. And not the red of a rooster's feathers, but shining, as if polished metal could be red. Per cried out,
Martley, I feared you drowned or arrow shot. I am so glad you're alive. Where were you?
The bird bobbed her head as if in agreement. Then she spoke, her voice and inflection oddly human. She opened her wings.
I fly with the dragons!
Full of satisfaction, she turned her bright eyes on me.
A way out is a way in.
A shiver went up my back.
You came to my cell,
I exclaimed. But she paid me no mind. She had turned her head to stare up at the sky.
Ice fire! Ice fire!
I saw confusion cloud Per's face, but before I could wonder what the word meant, I heard him. The black dragon came, not over the sea as the others did, but from inland. He announced himself with one roar.
Ice fire! I return, and I bring your death.
Every driving beat of his powerful wings brought him closer. He grew ever larger until he seemed impossibly big. How could such a creature exist, let alone fly? But fly he did, and as he approached the castle, we heard only his wings. Then a cry burst from him, a sound so powerful that all of us covered our ears. But while we might hold out the sound of his roar, the sense of it imprinted itself in our minds.
Remember me, Clarez? Recall how you poisoned us with a feast of toxic cattle? Recall how you gathered to dance and sing to welcome us to your treachery? Recall how you butchered my fellows as they lay dying. How when I fought you, you filled my mind with a curse. Bury yourself in the ice. Back then, I fled. You shamed me. You made me the last dragon in the world. But I shall not leave even one of you to recall how you all died this day.
The blue took panicked flight from the tower, a jay rousted by a raven. The black dragon did not perch. He dived on the turret of one inner tower, hitting it with his talons and the full force of his weight and impetus. It fell, tumbling like a child's blocks. I thought he would ride it down, but his great wings beat, and he lifted again. High he rose and higher. The blue and green dragons circled wide around him, no longer actively harrying the castle. They kept their distance, and I wondered if they feared they might become his meal. Then he fell like a stone, straight down, and only in the final moment did he change his course with a shifting of his wings, driving himself against one of the skull towers. It was a sturdier thing than the graceful inner towers. Even so, it could not withstand the blow. The fearsome head tipped as if it had taken a monstrous slap. A shocking crack ran down the structure, and as the dragon clung to the skull, pushing and flapping, the crack opened wider. The skull overbalanced, and ice fire lifted away from it as it leaned ever so slowly, and then fell. Even at our distance, the sound it made as it struck the earth was impressive. From her perch on Per's shoulder, the crow opened wide her wings. A string of enthusiastic caws burst from her throat. She bobbed her head and declared,
"Dragons! My dragons!"
Per put his hands on her to prevent her from taking flight.
"It's too dangerous," he warned her.
"My dragons!"
she insisted. "She has finally found a flock to join," he observed to me. "Her own kind always pecked her, but the dragons have taken her in." His eyes on the dragons and their destruction, Beloved asked,
"If a flock of crows is a murder, what should we call a group of dragons?"
"A catastrophe of dragons," someone said, with no humor in his deep voice. "Stay where you are."
The outcry from one of our guardians jerked my attention back to the land end of the dock. A familiar figure stood there. My heart lifted for a moment, and then I wondered, friend or foe?
"I have no weapon,"
Prilcop pointed out. I wasn't sure of that. Two of the whites we had freed from their cells stood behind him. They had recovered enough to be carrying a large bucket between them.
"I've brought you water, and I offer you shelter in a friend's home."
He turned and gestured at the two whites to bring the bucket forward. They exchanged a look, and one shook his head vigorously. They set the bucket down and retreated farther down the dock. Prilcop stared after them. Then he walked ponderously back to the bucket, took it up, and walked slowly toward us, the water sloshing over the brim at each step. We watched him come, and all I could think of was the water. He clutched the bail of the bucket in both hands, and it was splashing on his legs and feet. I suddenly saw that he was an old man, and not very strong anymore. Behind him, in the town, people were leaving their homes, some scampering like frightened squirrels, and others moving purposefully, pushing barrows and carrying large packs as they fled. Some of them had clearly understood what Icefire was saying. I wondered if those who lived here knew tales of how the servants had killed and driven off the dragons. Had they ever imagined such a vengeance? Beloved walked past our glowering guardians, went over to Prilcop, and took the pail.
"Thank you, old friend," he said, and left Prilcop standing there as he brought the water back to us. "Are you sure it's clean, not poisoned? I heard that dragon say they were poisoners."
This from the tattooed woman.
"It's not poisoned,"
Beloved assured them. He stooped and found a ladle in the bucket. He dipped up water and drank it.
"It tastes fine. It's even cool. Come and drink. Water for Boyo first."
We gave Boyo three dippers of water, and no one objected. I took one, even though they said I could have more. The guards had not given up their vigilance. I slipped closer to stand near them and hear what Prilcop was saying.
"They're destroying it all,"
Prilcop called to Beloved.
"What B began with her fire, they are finishing with acid and blows of their wings and tails. If they do not stop, Clara's castle will be nothing but rubble. I come to beg you to call them back. Let us change this path, Beloved. Negotiate a peace for us. Help me return Clara's to what it should have been, what it once was."
Beloved shook his head, and I do not think he was sad to refuse.
"Easy enough to negotiate a peace with us. Allow us to leave on the first ship that will take us. That is all we ask. We have what we came for."
Prilcop nodded.
"The stolen child."
In a flat voice, Beloved added,
"We can do nothing about the dragons. Their vengeance is even older than mine. They will be thorough, and nothing will stop them."
Prilcop said nothing, but his mouth sagged and his face grew older. The blue dragon had claimed the walkway on top of the west wall. He paraded up and down it. His lashing tail raised blocks of stone, destroying the crenellation. From time to time, he threw back his head and then snapped it forward, showering the interior of the fortress with acid. I could not see the green, and then, with a wild roar, a much larger blue dragon flashed past the two remaining skull-topped towers. A smaller red one flew low over the town and then landed at the town end of the causeway. On that dragon's back was something I could not make out at that distance. A rider?
Hebe! Beautiful Hebe!
The crow cried. She tried to lift from Per's shoulder, but he caught her, his hands moving so fast I barely saw them.
Martley, she goes to battle. It is no place for you. Stay here with me, where you're safe.
Safe? Safe?
And the crow laughed, a terrible cackle. Per had pinned her wings to her side, and she did not struggle. But the moment he set her back on his shoulder, she leapt from him. With two flaps of her wings, she was up, and then arrowing toward the red dragon.
I come! I come! I come!
As you will, Per said sadly. Likely she is right. There is no safety here for her, or us.
The great blue dragon circled back. As Icefire had, she announced her name with a roar.
Tintaglia, she trumpeted. Vengeance for my eggs stolen and destroyed, for our serpents imprisoned and abused.
She struck the tower a lashing blow with her tail as she passed. We stared. Nothing happened. And then slowly, slowly, the skull tipped back, beheaded from its stone support. It fell, dragging half the damaged tower with it. We heard the distant crash of cascading stones.
You spent so many years at Clara's. As a child, you labored long in the scroll rooms. Your own dreams were stored there. You feel nothing?
Prilcop asked quietly.
I feel many things right now. Relief is one of them.
Beloved stared coldly at the falling walls of Clara's castle.
Satisfaction that what was done to me will never happen to another child. And the children that were in there?
Prilcop was outraged. Beloved shook his head.
This is the vengeance of dragons. No one can stop it.
He turned to look at his friend, and his voice was terrible. The voice of a prophet.
I spent him, Prilcop. I plunged Fitzchivalry into death a dozen times. No one can know what that cost me. No one. This is my future, my path, chosen by me as the white prophet of this time. Are you so blind? He and I, we did it all. We brought the dragons back into the world.
He turned away from all of us. Arms crossed on his chest, he shouted,
Servants! You made this path long before I came into the world. You set us on this rutted route to this future. When you killed and destroyed for your own comfort, when your own wealth and power were all you cared for, this is the path you created. You delayed this reckoning.
His voice dropped lower, and suddenly he was coldly calm.
But my catalyst and I have won. The future is here, and the vengeance is greater than even a prophet could predict.
His voice, so grand a moment before, cracked and broke as he said,
Bought with his death.
The sea wind blew past him, and his pale hair stirred slightly in its passage. I did not have to touch him to see that he had been a Nexus. For one instant, all the possible paths that had been shone around him. Then they moved, converging into one bright way before it, too, exploded into a thousand, thousand paths. They dazzled my eyes, and I could not look away. But abruptly, he dropped his hands, and he was just a slender, pale man, as he asked on a sob,
Do you think I would undo one moment of my catalyst's work?
He knew, as I did, that it all had to end. Beloved was as much the destroyer as I had ever been. Pull out the deepest root of the weeds. I did not know I was going to do it, but I stepped forward. I took his gloved hand in mine, and we stood, staring at Prilcop.
Will they destroy the town as well?
Prilcop whispered in horror.
They will,
Beloved affirmed. Our small party had gathered around and behind him.
Prilcop, I see one narrow path for you. Take those you have and flee to the hills. It is all you can do and all I can give you. This is a balancing of the scales that was long in coming.
He shook his head.
It began not with me, but with the dragons, and the dragons have come to finish it.
Prilcop looked toward the castle, his hands trembling. With no fear, Beloved went to him and embraced him. He spoke quietly.
Only for what you must feel, old friend, I am sorry. Take those you can. Guide them toward a better path.
There were children there,
Prilcop said brokenly. There were children at Withywoods, I reminded him. I did not say I had been one of them.
They have done nothing to deserve such punishment.
And my folk were just as innocent. Could he not hear what I was telling him? Purr was suddenly beside me, his round face contorted by an anger I'd never seen before.
Did my father and grandfather deserve to die so that you could kidnap a girl? Your people erased my mother's memories of me so that she denied me and sent me away. Neither of us will ever get past that. Do you understand that when the servants came to Withywoods, they destroyed my life as well as Bee's? And now her father is dead because of what they did.
I suddenly understood something from a long-ago dream. Did you know that they arranged for nets to be set off Others Island to capture and kill the serpents so that they would die and never become dragons?
But,
Prilcop began. Beloved stepped back from him. His voice was harsh.
No one deserves to die like that. But very little of what happens to us in life is what we deserve.
Still the old man stood staring at us, pleadingly.
Prilcop, time does not pause. Go.
Prilcop stared at him, as if shocked beyond words. Then he turned and stumbled away. In a few steps he recovered himself and began a dogged trot. I watched him go. Our companions looked at us questioningly, but there was nothing more to add. Boyo is awake, I said quietly. Ant turned and hastened to his side. He was sitting up, but looked worse than he had. Beyond him, out in the water, something moved.
What's that?
Someone demanded, drawing our attention to the other end of the dock.
There's someone in the water,
Spark cried. All her heart was in her shout, and with no hesitation she leapt from the dock to swim to the man who clung to a bit of plank and doggedly kicked. We watched her go, some shouting encouragement. She reached him, and we saw her take her place beside him on the broken board. They both kicked then, and slowly, slowly, they reached a point where Boyo suddenly cried out,
It's my da! He's alive! But where is my mother?
He staggered to his feet, swayed, and then Ant seized his good arm to support him. The sailor called Clef dived into the water and swam toward them.
Brash and Trell, Purr said. Paragon's captain.
His face shone with hope. Agonizing moments crawled by as they slowly drew closer. The waves pushed them toward us. Boyo stood, his burnt arm held close to his chest, his scorched face full of hope and misery. When they were close enough, Purr climbed down to help first Brashen and then Clef climb out of the water. The moment the man was on the dock, he sank down and Ant lowered Boyo beside him. The father reached for his son, then drew back, not daring to touch his burnt flesh. They both wept as the captain brokenly explained that he had seen Althea briefly when the ship fell apart, but not since. He had been swimming from raft to raft of wreckage, looking for some sign of her, but found nothing. When the wreckage began to drift out of the harbor, he knew he had to try to return to shore before he was carried out with it. Too weary to swim any longer, he had clung to a plank and stubbornly worked his way back to us.
Those who clustered around father and son smiled and wept. Spark, I noticed, isolated herself to sit and weep noisily, yet privately. Lant was gone. As gone as Althea, and probably others of the crew I had never met and knew nothing about. When the captain saw the carefully composed body on the dock, he gave an exclamation of both pity and despair, and Boyo began to weep afresh.
I failed, Da. Twice I tried to get through the flames to the figurehead, but the pain drove me back. In the end, it was Kennetson who saved Paragon from dying. He claimed the silver from me and ran right into the flames. I heard him screaming, but he didn't stop. He saved our ship.
The man said nothing to try to comfort Boyo, but just let him weep. The two small dragons that had been his ship were like fluttering ribbons in the sky. Though so much smaller than the other dragons, they were just as intent on the destruction of the castle. He watched them.
So many losses, he said.
The red dragon rampaged on the ground. The ship's dragons soon joined her. They were thorough in their destruction, moving methodically from structure to structure. They started at the houses and businesses closest to the causeway. There were no flames. The red dragon spat acid, and then, when the structures weakened, turned them to rubble with a blast of her wings or a sweep of her tail. We heard the crashes and the shouts, and the stream of fleeing folk became thicker. Some fled up into the pastures and farmland behind the town. Others pushed carts and followed the road that wound up into the hills. I sat on the dock and looked up, past the roofs of the warehouse and fine homes, to the hills beyond. People joined the sheep there and then pushed on, to vanish over the ridgeline. Slowly, slowly, the summer evening waned away. There were no flames to light the night. When Icefire and Tintaglia had finished with the castle, they joined the smaller ones in a very organized destruction of the city. There was nothing random in what they did. The ruination was as coldly calculated as anything Dwalia or Capra had visited upon me. Mothers fled with their babies in their arms. Fathers with small children in barrows or on their shoulders ran past. I watched. This was not justice at work, but vengeance. Vengeance took no account of innocence or right. It was the chain that bound horrific events together, that decreed that one awful act must beget another worse one, that would lead to yet a third. It came to me, slowly, that this chain would never end. Those who survived here would hate dragons, and the folk of the six duchies, and perhaps the pirate isles. They would tell tales of this day to their descendants, and it would not be understood or forgiven. It would some day beget more vengeance. I wondered if that was a thread that was wrapped around every path. I wondered if ever a white prophet would come who could snap it. Boyo suffered from his burns and many of the others from their lesser injuries, but we dared not leave our little spot of safety while dragons walked the streets and flew over the houses. I dozed in the night, when sleep eventually triumphed over fear and discomfort. In the dawn, I woke to a place I had never been. Every structure in the town was roofless, with walls cracked and crumbled. The harbour was studded with masts of sunken wrecks. Of the piers and docks, only ours was left intact. The scene was eerie, lifeless. The streets were empty of people. I woke because Spark shook my shoulder. I sat up to see the smaller blue and green dragons advancing down the dock.
What do they want?
One of the guards demanded in a shaking voice. Beloved went to him and pushed aside his blade.
They come for their own, for one they claimed as kin. Step back, for they will pass whether you clear away or not.
Brashen stood over his huddled son, for Boyo could no longer stand for the pain of his burns. Some of the other sailors retreated to the end of the dock, but Spark, Purr, and I remained where we were. The planks of the dock complained under their weight as the dragons came toward us, turning their gleaming heads on their serpentine necks and snuffing the air near Beloved. Their eyes spun like twirling silver buttons. The blue opened his mouth, the better to test the air near him.
Tell me what they say, Purr breathed beside me.
They have said nothing yet, I replied.
He took my hand in his, and I wondered if he sought to give me courage or borrow mine.
It did not matter. I welcomed it. Small dragons were still very large creatures, and they were very close to us. But even in my fear and sorrow, their beauty made me smile.
"We have come for him,"
the blue one said, and I repeated that softly to Purr. Beloved turned back toward us.
"The dragons that were once Paragon the ship have come to claim the body of Kennetson."
I saw the uneasiness that went through all the others. The tattooed woman who had rowed the boat for us asked,
"To do what?"
Beloved looked down at the body and then around at the gathered crew.
"They will eat his body to keep his memories among their own."
At the looks of horror that his words woke, he said,
"The dragons consider doing that an honor."
"Is this a fitting end for the Prince of the Pirate Isles?"
Two men stepped forward, tears tracked wet on one man's face, but he held a knife in his hand and faced a dragon. There would be trouble. Beloved spoke.
"Is it so different from how Paragon took Kennet's memories when he died on the ship's deck? Kennetson goes where his father's and great-grandfather's ship has gone, and that is a fitting end for any pirate."
Only Beloved seemed resigned that these dragons would eat the body of one who had been a companion to so many of them. But when he motioned to all of us to step back, everyone moved aside to let the dragons pass. The dock creaked and swayed on its pilings as the dragons halted by the body and looked down at it. I had thought there would be some ceremony, some decorous sharing. But no. Eager to be first, both green and blue dragon darted their heads down to the corpse. We'd had only a piece of scorched sail canvas to cover him with, so nothing shielded us from the sight of the blue dragon seizing Kennetson by the head and tugging the corpse upright as the green's head snaked in to shear off the bottom half of his body. Before anyone could gasp, the blue had lifted the head half with its now unraveling entrails and gulped it in. Bits of Kennetson's guts littered the dock. One of his sailors turned and harshly vomited over the side of the dock. Ant had lifted her hands to cover her eyes. Boyo clung to his father like a child, and Brashen's face was white. Spark gripped my other hand and swayed slightly.
"It is done,"
Beloved said, as if that somehow made what we had seen better. As if the gory bits littering the planks would disappear.
"His memories will be within me,"
the blue dragon announced.
"And in me,"
the green said, almost argumentatively.
"I will sleep now,"
the blue announced. He turned carefully, but his tail still swept dangerously close. A step he took, and then he halted. He lowered his head and his eyes whirled as he snuffed Brashen's chest. He turned his head sideways and regarded Boyo.
"They burned us,"
he thrummed, as if he recalled something from long ago. He made a low sound, like an immense cauldron coming to a boil.
"They have paid,"
he said. A longer time he stared.
"Boyo, I give you the honor of my name. Carrig."
He lifted his head.
"And I take part of yours. Carrig Vestrit, I shall be. I will remember you."
Head up, the small dragon moved ponderously down the dock and toward the shore. The green surveyed us silently. She drew breath and then reared up on her hind legs. She opened her mouth wide, and in the scarlet and orange striped maw she displayed, I saw death. Everyone crowded back, and one man fell from the dock to the water as she hissed without venom. She closed her jaws and looked down on us.
"I was ever a dragon,"
she said disdainfully. The dock swayed from her impetus, and I feared it would collapse and spill all of us into the water as she sprang into the air. We cowered like rabbits as the wind of her wings swept us. A few moments later, the blue took flight, and we were left as we had been. Ant was weeping with terror. She shot to Brashen's side, and he put a sheltering arm around the young deckhand. Purr scanned the skies.
I don't see or hear any of the other dragons.
They are likely gone to sleep off their gorging.
Beloved spoke reluctantly, as if he did not wish to remind us of what they had gorged on. But no one was deceived, and an uneasy silence followed his words. Beloved stood watching them fly against the darkening sky, and I could not read his expression. His shoulders rose and then fell.
I am so tired, he said,
and I felt he spoke the words to someone who wasn't there. When he turned back to us, he spoke briskly.
The streets are quiet, and the dragon's gone. Now we must go to salvage food and find a better place to shelter tonight.
Brashen and Ant, and a sailor named Tuan, stayed with Boyo while the rest of us ventured out as a tight party, for the tattooed woman insisted we be defended. Clef went with us, carrying a knife and looking as if he wished to be attacked. We soon saw that not every inhabitant had fled. Some peered at us from the doubtful shelter of half-tumbled walls. Others were out salvaging or looting. They were poorly armed, and most fled as soon as they saw us. Once, a flung brick struck Spark a glancing blow on the shoulder, but there was no sign of the assailant. Nonetheless, we took that warning to heart. We salvaged canvas from the tumble of a sailmaker's sheds. Beloved sent sailors back with enough for a sling to carry Boyo. We made a camp against the standing wall of the sailmaker's house. The night was mild. Purr cut a square of canvas for me to sit on. One of the men fetched water in Prilcop's bucket. Beloved did not wish to let me go with those who went to search for food, but I was too hungry to obey him. It was not a difficult search. This town had lived in plenty, and had not taken much of it when they fled. Some of the gardens had fruit trees. After days of being at sea, we little cared if it was ripe or not. We filled our shirt fronts. Purr found loaves and buns, and even little cakes scattered amid the wreckage of a bakery, and I found a tub of butter. I have heard that grease is good for a burn, I mentioned to Purr. He looked doubtful, but we took it along with our other looted food. Boyo was very good to me, as was Brashen. And Kennetson, he added in a tighter voice. Althea, Cord. I had not stopped to think that he might have made fast friends among the crew. I thought of that as we walked, eating as we went. I had Purr, but if he had friends here, did I have less of him? Who cared for me in this world? Nettle and Riddle seemed very far away, and now they had a baby to share. Even Wolffather was gone from me now. As I followed Purr and the others through the deepening dark, the world seemed to stretch wider and emptier around me. When we returned, we found Brashen setting cool, wet rags on Boyo's burns. The younger man lay very still. His father had cut away much of his clothing, and his burns were more extensive than I had thought. There were places where the fabric of his shirt had adhered to the burnt flesh, and there it stayed, colorful flags on scorched territory. Purr knelt on one side of him. "Do you think we can wake him enough to eat some bread?" he asked Brashen, who shook his head. His face was lined, and there was some gray in his dark, curly hair. He looked at me and said,
"So this is the child we came to rescue. All of this death and destruction, to bring her home," he said bitterly, and I suspected he thought me a bad bargain. Could I fault him for that? I had cost him a ship and his wife. Perhaps his son. I knelt on the other side of his son with the butter tub. Clef had followed us and stood wordlessly behind me, along with a tattooed woman that everyone called Navigator. "I brought this to dress his wounds," I told him. His dark eyes were empty of hope, and he did not object. I dug my fingers into the soft yellow butter and very gently began to smooth it onto Boyo's face. The bubbled flesh felt terribly wrong under my fingertips. One of the big blisters broke and oozed fluid that mixed with the butter. Wrong. It was all wrong. What was right? I touched the flesh next to the burn. That was right. That was what his skin should be like. My fingertips dragged on the unburnt skin. I wished I could pull it over the scorched flesh like a cool coverlet. His father abruptly leaned closer.
"Butter does that?"
he demanded in a stunned voice.
"No, farseers do that," Purr choked,
and then lifted his voice to shout, "Amber, come here!" I could not be bothered with any of them. This was fascinating. It was like using a small brush or cut plume to put the colour exactly where I wanted it on a painting. With inks, I could make the bee or the flower precisely as it was supposed to be. With my fingers, I could draw the healthy flesh back over the burnt parts. No, that wasn't exactly it. Starting at the healthy flesh was a good idea, but the clean skin was a spreading thing, like green plants growing over scorched earth. I pushed the debris of dead skin out of the way.
"Bee, stop that. Boyo needs to rest and to eat. Later, perhaps, you can do more. Bee, can you hear me? Her, I dare not touch her. You must do it. Lift her under her arms and draw her away from Boyo."
The next thing I knew, I sat by the fire, blinking. Per was standing over me, a peculiar look on his face.
"I'm so hungry and tired," I told him.
A smile quirked one corner of his mouth. "I imagine you are. Well, we have bread and butter, and some fish."
My nose told me of chicken spitted over our fire. The others had been as successful in their scavenging. They had a cask of something and were breaking a hole in the top of it. I suddenly smelled beer.
I stood up unsteadily and looked over toward Boyo. His father was smiling at me, but his cheeks were wet with tears. All doubt of me was cleared from his face. Beloved knelt by the lad. I had not healed his entire face, but he could close both his eyes now, and his mouth was intact.
"He's wakeful enough that you should get him to eat. It draws strength from the injured person when a far-seer heals someone."
Beloved gave me a worried look.
"It wearies the farseer as well."
A louder voice cut through his words.
"Ah, I see that you have recovered the lost child, and if my ears do not deceive me, she is indeed her father's daughter."
I startled, for the stranger had come up on us quietly. He was like no one I had ever seen, like a creature from a tale. He was tall and thin, gleaming scarlet, and dressed in bright garb. I stared at him.
"Rapscal," Beloved said under his breath.
Then Per handed me a torn slab of bread, the cut end of it dabbed in the butter. I bit off such a large bite that I got butter on both my cheeks. I didn't care. I chewed as I stared at the red lizard man. His clothing had lots of leather straps and buckles. Things were clipped to him, a water skin, and other gear I didn't recognize. He reminded me of a festival puppeteer, but Beloved and Per seemed daunted by him. He looked around at us, and then added,
"And where is Fitzchivalry and Kennetson? I promised he would fly with us to take our vengeance. Tomorrow we scour the hills for any who escaped us. He will enjoy that hunt."
"Neither survived,"
Beloved said in a tight voice.
"Oh dear, I do hope it was not the dragons. My apologies if it was. They are very focused when angered."
Beloved looked stunned at the man's casual apology.
"No, both died before the dragons came," he said in a subdued voice.
"Oh well, that's good then. I would have hated it to have been the dragons. Very sorry to hear it, of course, and that the Prince of the Pirate Isles is dead. He seemed quite taken with Hebe, and she enjoyed his compliments. I ran into some of your fellows a short time ago. They told me of your other losses, including young Lant. A shame. He seemed such an engaging fellow."
"He was," Per said quietly, and suddenly the red man seemed to realize that perhaps his words had been thoughtless.
"Well, I should find some sustenance for myself. Hebe is sleeping and I have some time to myself. Vivacia will soon be arriving. We overflew her on our way here. Doubtless she and her crew will be disappointed to discover they have missed the battle."
He turned and began to walk away, leaving as abruptly as he had arrived.
"Red man,"
Navigator called after him,
"stay and eat with us. And drink to Kennetson, Prince of the Pirate Isles."
He turned back, his gleaming eyes very wide.
"I would be welcome here?"
And my dragon?
He seemed surprised.
We will remember our dead tonight,
Clef told him. Rapscal nodded slowly and then suddenly grinned wide.
We would be honored to join you. She's sleeping, her belly full of meat. When she wakes, I will bring her here.
He turned and hurried off. The rest gaped after him, but I filled my mouth again. Spark came to find us, carrying a basket full of onions and carrots. We harvested one of the gardens, she said quietly, as if a bit ashamed. There was little left of the house. I do not think the owners will be returning. How is Boyo? Much better. Bee can heal, like a father. And Vivacia is on our way here. Perhaps we have a way home, Per told her. She smiled. Good news all round, then, she said. But her voice held the note of sorrow suppressed. I shall be glad to leave this place, she added.
As shall we all,
Beloved affirmed. It was a peculiar night. Someone brought brash and beer in a bowl. He drank it slowly, but did not leave Boyo's side. Rapscal did come back, and with him the scarlet dragon named Hebe. I was surprised to find that Hebe was shy and held herself apart and did not speak at all. Some of the crew got very drunk and sang songs about loot and sailing. Navigator was as drunk as any, and showing all that her tattoos were actually charts of harbors and waterways. After a time, she and Rapscal went apart from us, for she wished to show him a large tattoo on her belly. Per put my piece of canvas down on the far side of the fire from the singing and laughing crew. When he came to sit beside me, he smelled of beer. Later, Spark came to lie down beside me. She wept quietly in the dark. Beloved sat apart from us. I watched him until I fell asleep. My last thought that night was that he was as alone as I was. I woke to birds calling. I looked up at tree branches with bits of blue sky beyond them.
Dwalia!
My entire body jerked with fear. Then Per said, Bee? You've slept a long time. Are you waking up now? I sat up slowly. Per was bare-chested. Oh, his shirt had been my blanket. I offered it to him wordlessly, and he spoke as he put it back on. Vivacia came into the harbor early this morning. Well, to the harbor. Too shallow for her to come closer. Their boat came ashore looking for us. That red fella, Rapscal, he'd overflown them and shouted we were here. They've already taken Boyo. We'll go next. I looked around me, blinking.
Is there food?
I asked stupidly.
There is.
The bread was stale, but he had saved me a peach. He warmed the bread on a stick over the embers and dunked it in the butter. It was good. I washed my hands and face and said, The birds woke me. Did you have a blue crow with some red feathers? It seemed a dream.
She went with the dragons, I think.
They gave her such colors. She loves them.
He seemed sad. I changed the subject. Who is Vivacia, and why has she come?
She's a live ship, like Paragon was. She came following the dragons and Rapscal. She'd gone to Others Island. There was a battle there, too, to kill all the others who had been taking the dragon eggs or capturing the little serpents as they hatched. Then Vivacia said they must now come here to help Tintaglia take revenge.
I see, I said, but only to stop his flow of words. My head felt too foggy to take on so much information. I stood up slowly and looked around. Spark was drifting listlessly about our camp, as if looking for anything that needed to be done. Her eyes were red, her mouth drooping. The others were gone.
Did Beloved go to the ship with the others?
No, he went up into the hills to try to find his way back to the tunnel. He went before in the night, but could not find it. So he got up very early, as soon as it was light, to try again.
And he didn't wake me to go with him.
Anger coursed through me.
Nor me, nor Spark. He told Aunt to tell us where he'd gone.
He put more bread on the toasting stick. I think he needed to go alone, Bee.
And what about what I might need?
I raged. Feeling the anger shoot through me was as heady as feeling skill rush from me.
like the night the serpent spit had gotten in my cuts.
"Bee?"
Per said, and stepped a little back from me. I saw Beloved at the edge of the camp. He walked slowly, looking at the ground. I did not run to him. I shouted, "Did you see him? You went without me!" I could not keep the anger from my voice.
"No."
His voice was a hoarse admission of defeat.
"I found the tunnel mouth again, but it was as I feared. At a high tide, it floods full."
I winced. I did not want to think of my father's body floating in cold seawater while fish nibbled at him. "He's dead. I told you that. I felt it." He didn't look at me. With an effort, he said,
"Spark, Per, if there's anything you want to take, gather it. I promised Winthrow I would not delay the sailing. There's probably a boat waiting for us now."
Per had piled fruit onto a square of canvas. He bagged it up and said, "That's it. Ready to go." "I'm taking nothing from here," Spark said. Beloved looked at me. I shrugged. Nothing. Taking nothing. Leaving everything.
"I know he's dead,"
he admitted brokenly. He finally turned toward me. The rims all around his pale eyes were red. There were deep lines around his mouth. He looked at me.
"You are all I have left of him now."
I spoke very quietly. "Then you have nothing at all."
Chapter 40. Warm Water. Battle death to your last breath, and even unknown, you are a hero. Whimper your way into darkness, and your name will become a taunt of cowardice. Chalcedian saying, "Dying is boring," Night Eyes observed. I drew a deeper breath. "Perhaps you're not taking it as personally as I am." My voice sounded strange to me. Water had risen in the chamber, and I had wondered if I would drown, trapped on my back with my head lower than my hips and my legs pinned between stone and stone. It was among the worst deaths I could have imagined for myself, but it had not even wet my hair. If it had come that high, I probably would have drunk some of it, salt water or not, I was so thirsty. The water was retreating now. The high tide had not reached me this time. Perhaps the next tide would reach higher. I would almost welcome it, I decided. I had never expected to wake in my body again, never expected to endure physical discomfort again. Now it seemed unfair that the pain from my trapped legs was not enough to drive hunger and thirst from my thoughts. I wrapped my arms around my body. I was cold. Not the cold that kills, but the cold that makes one stiff and miserable.
"Your death is personal, little brother. When you go, so do I. You should have stayed with B. All the same, when you perish, I go too."
The blackness was absolute. Either I was blind, or no light reached this chamber. Likely, both were true. But I didn't regret giving the fool my strength and my eyes. I hoped it had been enough to get them out of this tunnel and back to Paragon. I hoped they had boarded the ship, hoisted anchor, dropped sail, and fled without another thought for me. I tried again to move. The edges of the stone steps dug into my hips, the middle of my back and my shoulders. Cold and hard. The sword slash still hurt, and the back of my neck itched maddeningly. I scratched it again. It was the only discomfort I could do anything about.
"So the plan is to lie here until we die?"
"It's not a plan, Night Eyes. It's inevitable."
"I thought you were more of a wolf than that."
That stung. I scowled and spoke aloud into the darkness.
"Give me a better plan, then." "Make up your mind. Is death a friend? Then go joyfully to hunt with it, as I did. If it's an enemy, then fight it. But don't sag here like a wounded cow, waiting for predators to finish it off. You are not prey, nor I. If we must die, let us die as wolves.
What would you have me do? Chew off my legs? A brief silence. Then,
could you do that?
I don't bend that way. My teeth are wrong, and I'd likely bleed to death before I escaped.
Then why did you suggest it?
I was being sarcastic. Oh. B was not sarcastic. I enjoyed that about her. Tell me of your time with her. A longer pause in his thoughts. Then,
no. Fight your way out of this and live, and perhaps she will tell you herself. I am not going to share tales of her hardship while you lie here and moan like a wounded sow.
Her hardship. How bad was it?
Bad enough.
His rebuke stung in a way that only his disdain of me had ever achieved. I tried again to shift my legs. Useless. The fallen beam pinned me just above the knees. I could not get any leverage. I tried to remember if I'd had a long knife in my pack. The wolf was right about that aspect of my predicament. I did not want to linger like this. Would I go so far as to sever my legs to escape? A ridiculous idea. My knife would never go through leg bones. Was the ship's hatchet in my bag? I groped for my pack. I'd had it slung over my shoulder before the blast flung me down the steps. It was gone. My groping fingers found only loose gravel and rubble, and standing water if I stretched my arms as far as I could past my head. I paddled my fingers in the water and then wiped grit and dust from my face with my wet hand. The warm water felt good. I reached my hand into it again and trailed my chilled fingers in it. Warm water. Warm water? I froze. In my experience, two things gave off warmth. Living creatures and fire. My wit told me there were no other living creatures in my vicinity. A fire in water was not possible. For a single chilling moment, I recalled that forged people were invisible to my wit, yet alive and giving off warmth. But I had not encountered a forged one in decades, not since the Red Ship Raiders had created them during our war with the Out-Islanders.
We found that hot spring once.
It stank. I smell nothing.
Nor I.
I opened my eyes wide and strained to see something, anything, but still there was nothing. I firmed my will to iron and reached out again, groping. The water was definitely warmer. I strained my arms in that direction as far as I could. I felt the slash in my leg, straining with my reaching. Warmer yet. My fingertips brushed something I recognized at once. The side of my pack. Just a little more. I strained, dragged my fingertips down the sturdy fabric, seeking something to grip. Instead, I felt it overbalance and slip away from me. With a muffled thunk, it fell down one step, hopelessly out of my reach now. And that sound, the noise of something solid and dense, made me recall what had weighted my pack. One of Shade's fire pots was in there, with the heavy tube of dragon silver, and the elderling fire brick. I wondered which side of the brick was now up. I wondered if Shade's fire pot could explode under water. The brick could not set fire to it. Was mere heat enough to set it off? What happened to dragon silver when it was heated? Probably nothing. Some time passed. A lot of time, or a little time. In the dark, degrees of pain, hunger, and thirst were more potent measures than time. Occasionally, I shifted to put the pressure of the edges of the steps in different uncomfortable parts of my body. I scratched my neck where it itched. I crossed my arms on my chest. I uncrossed my arms. I thought of B, of the fool. Had they escaped? had they reached the ship safely. Perhaps they were even now on their way home. I yearned after them and then rebuked